This is the last day of this November 2014 7-day session. We'll take up another koan today. This is from the Mumon Khan, the gateless barrier, and it's number 5, Kyogen's Man Up a Tree. Here's the case, and then we'll get to the commentary and verse later. Kyogen said, "It's like a man up a tree hanging from a branch by his teeth. His hands can't grasp a limb, his feet won't reach one. Under the tree there is another man who asks him the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the west. If he doesn't answer, he fails the questioner. If he does answer, he will lose his life. At such a time, what should he do?" Kyogen, that's his Japanese name. His Chinese name is Xiangyan, or something like that, as far as the pronunciation. Xiangyan. All we know is that he died in the year 898, as far as his years. He was a disciple of Guishan, or Japanese version is Isan. I'm reading here from Zen's Chinese Heritage by Andy Ferguson. He was known to be extremely intelligent and quick-witted, high IQ. He first studied under Hyakujo, or Baizhang, but it says here he was unable to penetrate the heart of Zen. After Baizhang died, Kyogen studied under Isan. Despite his cleverness, he was unsuccessful at realizing his teacher's meaning. Or we might say, because of his cleverness, he was unsuccessful at realizing his teacher's meaning. In the Hakuin chant that we just did, beyond clever words, it's one of the lines. We're enjoined to get beyond clever words. And then his story, the story of his frustration, his initial failure, is a famous one in Zen, and I'll read the whole thing. I'll use the Japanese name. One day, Isan said to Kyogen, "I'm not asking you about what's recorded in or what can be learned from the sutras." There's an exclamation mark here, so maybe the teacher was just exasperated with Kyogen coming in and quoting this sutra or that sutra. "I'm not asking you about that. You must say something from the time before you were born and before you could distinguish objects. I want to record what you say." Kyogen was confused, unable to answer. He sat in deep thought for some time and then mumbled a few words to explain his understanding. But Isan wouldn't accept this. Kyogen said, "Then would the master please explain it?" Isan said, "What I might say would merely be my own understanding. How could it benefit you?" Kyogen returned to the monk's hall and searched through the books he had collected. But he couldn't find a single phrase that could be used to answer Isan's question. He then sighed and said, "A picture of a cake can't satisfy hunger." He then burned all his books and said, during this lifetime, I won't study the essential doctrine. I'll just become a common mendicant monk, and I won't apply my mind to this anymore. He must have been just in despair, completely riddled with self-doubt and sense of failure. That he burned all his books. It's hard for those of us who are not brilliant scholars like Kilgan was to appreciate what a renunciation, what a act of practically suicide that is. How painful it must have been to burn all his precious books. But in that sacrifice, there was the seed of something to come. He tearfully left Isan. He then went traveling and eventually came to rest at the site of the grave of national teacher Nanyang Huizhong. This would be a respectable enough outcome for a Chinese monk in that age to tend the grave. This was considered a very meritorious thing, to tend the grave, keep it up, keep it free of weeds. One day, as he was scything grass, you know, one of these big old tools, the scythe, whoosh, whoosh, whoosh. A small piece of tile was knocked through the air and struck a stalk of bamboo. Upon hearing the sound of the tile hitting the bamboo, Kilgan instantly experienced vast enlightenment. He then bathed and lit incense, and bowing in the direction of Isan, he said, "The Master's great compassion exceeds that of my parents. Back then, if you had explained it to me, how could this have come to pass?" And then he wrote a verse. "One tuck, and all knowledge is forgotten. No artificial discipline is needed at all. In every movement I uphold the ancient way and never fall into the rut of mere quietism. Far and wide not a trace is left, and my senses are not fettered by rules of conduct. In every direction, the realized way, beyond all speech, the ultimate principle." Kilgan then dispatched a monk to take the verse to Isan and recite it. Upon hearing it, Isan said to his senior monk, Kyozan, he said, "This disciple has penetrated." But Kyozan was not so quick to pass Kilgan. He said, "This is a good representation of mind function, but wait, and I'll personally go and check out Kilgan's realization." And then when Kyozan got to Kilgan, Kyozan said, "Master Isan has praised the great matter of your awakening. What do you say as evidence for it?" So he came to test him. Kyogen then recited his previous verse. still got a little of the memorizer in there. Kyozan said, this verse could be composed from the things you've studied earlier. If you've had a genuine enlightenment, then say something else to prove it. So then Kyogen composed another verse. My poverty last year was not true poverty. This year it is the real thing. Last year a fine gimlet could find a place. This year even the gimlet is gone. So, nothing. From the very beginning, there's never been a single thing. A gimlet is some kind of a sharp instrument, maybe something like an ice pick. Previously, even such a fine tool could find a place to stand. This year, the whole thing is gone. And Kyozan said, I grant that you have realized the Zen of the Tathagatas. But as for the Zen of the ancestors, you haven't seen it even in your dreams. This is an old distinction from ancient China, two levels of realization. So he's granting him that he's had some Kensho, but not the ultimate. But is he just testing him here? So then Kyozan composed another verse. I have a single potential. It's seen in the twinkling of an eye. If you still don't understand, call the acolyte and ask him about it. Acolyte means a rank beginner, a novice. If you still don't understand, call the novice and ask him about it. So when Kyozan heard this verse, he reported to Isan, it's wonderful. Kyogen has realized the Zen of the ancestors. This story is such a poignant one. I remember how it would tear into my heart when I was still working on Mu, and Roshi Kaplo was reading it in Taisho. We don't know for sure, after he left Isan, we don't know for sure if he was doing Zazen seriously, day in and day out. I would guess that he must have been to keep his mind, or to bring his mind into this condition, from which his deep realization came. But we can also, and I think it says somewhere in one of the records, was that he gave up. He gave up trying to get something. That's a crucial point. And then he was just able to do pure Zazen for its own sake, with no end in mind, no goal. And then the gratitude later for Isan not having explained it to him. Zen is a practice of experience. What good could an explanation do? One person's explanation of his experience do for the other person? It could be inspiring. It's true, but it won't give you your own understanding. The value of these enlightenment accounts is just in inspiring us to work even harder but they don't really give us anything. I have a one other entry here for Kilgan. He entered the hall and addressed the monks, saying, "The way is attained by means of enlightenment and is not found in words." Yeah, he gets it now. "It is mysterious and majestic and without the slightest breach. Don't belabor your mind. Just turn the light inward. Those disciples using total effort every day to realize enlightenment are just backward and confused." In other words, stop grasping at something you imagine to be apart from you, somewhere out there, this enlightenment, somewhere in the future. This is just one of many cases of masters who had previously been scholars. Many of the great masters originally made a thorough study of the sutras. Our own Harada Roshi, that is Roshi Kaplow's, the first master he trained under in Japan, whose name we know from the Three Pillars of Zen, was a college mathematics professor before he became a monk and then eventually a master. And one more thing here. It just says, "To all of his disciples, Kilgan provided his teachings in a clear and direct manner. He left more than 200 verses that were composed to meet the situations he encountered, and these unmetered verses were popular throughout the country." And then he received the posthumous name Zen Master Harmonious Light. Now, back to our case. The case of the man up the tree. Sounds like a murder mystery. So Kilgan, in his brilliance, came up with this brilliant metaphor that he outlined for his monks. It's like a man up a tree hanging from a branch by his teeth. His hands can't grasp a limb, his feet won't reach one. Okay, this is bad enough. And this is sort of a classic kind of a cul-de-sac that the koans provide. There are others, there's so many of them, and each in its own way that puts us in this bind. There's a koan that says, how do you get out of a locked dungeon which you've just been thrown into? There's another one where the master stands over his disciple with a staff, and he says, if you say a word, I'll give you 30 blows. If you say no word, I'll give you 30 blows. Of course, the purpose of these koans and vines, is that if we take them seriously, they have the power to vault us out of this box of our rational, logical mind into the realm of true mind. So already he's up the tree, up the creek, but now this added element, under the tree, there's another man who asks him the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West. So not only is he up the tree, but now he has to respond somehow. But how? This question, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West, became a kind of a conventional way of asking what's the meaning of life? What is the ultimate? What is our essential nature? Any ultimate kind of question. It just became the thing that was often used, phrased that way. What is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West? Well, he's really in a pickle here. If he doesn't answer, he fails the questioner. If he does answer, boom, loses life. At such a time, what should he do? If he does answer, he will lose his life. Isan knew that if he tried to explain his own experience, as if there's some answer that you could write out or tell someone, that if he were to have explained this matter, not only would it be a terrible disservice to Kyogen, but it would have been a violation against himself. It really would be a losing his own life of integrity as a teacher. But more importantly, he would have been depriving Kyogen of his own experience. This koan is a classic metaphor for any dilemma. In this, the tree, throughout the world, in various cultures, the tree is used as a metaphor for life. And we can see this as the human predicament. As living human beings, endowed as we are, or afflicted, but yes, endowed with this discriminating intellect, that imposes on us this foreknowledge of our mortality. Here we are, what a situation. Knowing the certainty of death and the uncertainty of the time of our death. Knowing, once we are old enough to formulate the matter of death, knowing that, as Shantideva, the Indian monk of many centuries ago, said, knowing that which is not dear to me will not be, that which is dear to me will not be, and I will not be, and all will not be. In really the underpinning of this this dilemma, this human predicament, is the law of impermanence. That's the knowledge that we have to come to terms with, that everything is slipping away from us. Those who are closest to us, well, someday we will be separated from them. And if we live long enough, that we will suffer the losses attendant upon aging, physically, mentally, never knowing when we may be felled by, if not death, some terminal illness or some degenerative disease. But the root source of this, the suffering of this dilemma is delusion. The actual circumstances of life and death themselves are not the cause of suffering. It's our habit of dividing the world, of being caught between desires and aversions, our preferences. The classic Zen parable for this predicament we call human existence is the story of the man walking across the field and was suddenly spotted by a tiger. The tiger chased him to the edge of a cliff. The man, in absolute terror, found a vine and swung himself down over the edge of the cliff, hanging for dear life by this vine. The tiger came right up. He could feel the breath of the tiger on him, sniffing. And he looks down in absolute terror, and he sees far below another tiger waiting to eat him. And as he's hanging there on the vine, two mice, one black and one white, begin gnawing away at the vine. And then suddenly he spots a luscious strawberry right there. He plucks the strawberry, puts it in his mouth. Ah, how delicious. That man found the way out. But there's no strawberry in this tree, not even a not even a peach or a plum or he's just hanging there. Coming to Sesshin is itself willfully placing ourselves in this predicament. No matter where we are in our practice, no matter how many barriers we've passed or not passed, we all willfully put ourselves in this situation. And it's a measure of our spiritual health that we're willing to do so. because we know somehow in our heart of hearts, we know that putting ourselves in this kind of a situation is our way out. By facing it directly, giving ourselves no escape. And isn't that the way with life? Become so thoroughly, thoroughly one with everything in our daily life that the predicament vanishes. There's some words from this program for adolescents called Outward Bound. That I've often quoted in Sesshin. They say, if you can't get out of it, get into it. This is the challenge. This is our mission for anyone in spiritual practice, to find a way in and through this dilemma. Now, Mumon's commentary. Though your eloquence flows like a river, it is all to no avail. Even if you can explain the whole body of the Buddhist sutras, that also is useless. If you can really answer, you will revive the dead and kill the living. But if you can't answer, you must ask Maitreya when he comes. Maitreya is the supposed Buddha of the next world cycle. Every great eon of time, according to Buddhist teaching, has one full Buddha. So our era is Shakyamuni Buddha, and the Buddha of the next world cycle is Maitreya. And that's supposed to be something like 5,670,000 years from now, according to one reckoning. I Googled it. If you can really answer, you will revive the dead. We'll free ourselves from this dead world of thoughts. What a poor excuse for living, to be living in our thoughts. It's a great, great credit to Kyogen that someone of his brilliance, intellectual brilliance, was dissatisfied with that. It wasn't enough for him. How many women and men who have this kind of endowment, intellectual endowment, are still looking for something beyond all of that? And just one name springs to mind, Umon, Yunmen, the great Yunmen, was supposed to have also been incredibly brilliant and unsurpassed in his verbal abilities. And yet he saw through that. It wasn't enough. It wasn't enough to resolve the great matter of birth and death. There's a story from this collection of stories called Stories of the Spirit, Stories of the Heart, Parables of the Spiritual Path from Around the World, edited by Christina Feldman and Jack Kornfield. And here's how it goes. A learned scholar set forth on a long and difficult sea journey. Desiring to impress the crew with the depth of his learning, he would stop and question the simple sailors as they went about their duties. "Tell me, my good man," he would ask a sailor, "have you studied philosophy?" The sailor would answer, "Oh no, I'm just a simple sailor. I only know how to sail this ship from one shore to the other." The scholar would reply, "You poor man, you have wasted half your life." The following day, he would again question the sailor, "Have you studied geometry, my good man?" The sailor would reply again, "No, I'm sorry, sir. I just rig the sails and steer the ship." You know where this is going. The scholar again would shake his head in despair and say, "Only you poor fellow, dwelling in ignorance, you are wasting much of your life." Day after day, the questions would go on. "Have you studied geometry, anthropology, zoology, psychology?" The sailor could only shake his head in denial. One night, the ship foundered in a storm. The scholar anxiously watched the crashing waves and held tightly to the mast. The sailor approached him and asked him, "Have you, my good man, by any chance, studied swimology?" The scholar was bewildered. He just shook his head. And the sailor said, "That really is too bad. You have wasted your whole life, for the ship is sinking." Yet this world of thoughts can be so fascinating. What else would compel us to cling to our thoughts, to keep working them and working them, sifting through our thoughts all the time when we know better? We know there's nothing for us there, nothing of any really enduring, transcendent value. It's sort of like an addiction. For people of less faith than people here, it's the alternative is too frightening. Where would I be without my thoughts? Whom would I be without my thoughts? What would there be without this world of thoughts? Yes, what exactly? Find out, because it's a bright, rich, vivid world, this world of no thought. Talk about fascination. We're free of thoughts. The world just opens up. Everything becomes interesting. Fascinating. Because finally we are present. As long as we're in our thoughts, we're not present. We're somewhere else. We're divided. Free of thoughts, we're here. Fully here. Alive. Awake. Attuned to others. All right, our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.